Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Elaine Lockridge for the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show, fan number 2669, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And before I bring our guest on tonight, this is the topic night, open mic night, and we have a special survivor professional coming on tonight. This is her first night, so if you'd like to call in and welcome her to the show, the number is 646-595-2118. The number is 646-595-2118. And before we get to our special guest, I'd like to tell you about NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. We are a nonprofit 501c3, self-supporting through our own members and others that want to give. We do deal with child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. And we have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with two goals. Number one, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And number two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And again, I'm Pamela Elaine Lockridge. I am the associate producer. I schedule shows for people to come on the show, and I've just scheduled Macy Hamilton. She's going to be on the fourth Wednesday of every month, and she is our new professional. The fourth Thursday of every month. Thank you. Mark's my co-host tonight. And tonight she's on for the first time, and we're going to welcome her tonight. I'm opening your mic, Dr. Nisi.
Hi there, Miss Pam. Can you hear me?
I can. I can hear you well. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, I can.
All right. Let me read a little bit of your bio before we go into your story.
Sure.
From Houston, Texas. Yeah. She's from Houston. Nisi Hamilton, Dr. Nisi Hamilton, is from Houston, Texas. She was born to an adolescent mother who had herself been sexually trafficked by extended family members from 11 to 13. When she was born, she was left in the hospital, and where she was born is still a mystery to her. In foster care, Nisi was abused starting at 14. So we're going to leave it there, and we're going to let her take us from her earliest childhood memories up to the age of 14. And then we'll go to the panel and see if we have any people calling in that want to comment and interact with her. Dr. Nisi, the mic is yours.
Awesome. Welcome, guys. Welcome, guys. Welcome, guys, to the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. I am so honored to be here and to be to have my own show here with you guys. This is so amazing, Ms. Pam. I cannot thank you enough. Mr. Bill, I cannot thank you enough, who is the CEO. You guys are awesome, and I feel so much love already. And so let's get started. Ms. Pam, that was wonderful, because I know my bio can get a little lengthy there. But, yeah, so let's talk about that abuse. My abuse started as a young adult. And even thinking about it now, trying to facilitate that type of abuse with adults who themselves have been abused can put you in a mindset of, you know, thinking that you're going to formally be introduced to rejection, to hurt, to pain, and this is going to be your life, and it's going to be nonstop for the rest of your life. And that's what I was subjected to. I never received a mother's love, like a hard mother's love. And I've longed for it all of my life. So a lot of my followers, a lot of my listeners that are already on already, Ms. Pam told me a lot of you guys hopped on the call already, know that I call a lot of women in my life mother, or you'll see me call them mom. And that's mainly from the rejection, from not being able to have that experience with my own mother. My story is, you know, is like any other story of a child that's been abused in Houston, Texas, or anywhere else. I am not the only Niecy Hamilton walking around here. There are several children who have gone through what I've gone through, and some are living and have survived it, and some are not, and that is unfortunate. But I am here to empower you guys to be survivors and to become stewards, to become great stewards and build great character, and to let you know that there is life after child abuse. And so I just want to encourage the listeners that are already on, and let you know that, you know, that your voices are important and that your voices too deserve to be heard as well. Like Ms. Pam said so eloquently, my mother, she did birth me, and unfortunately, when I was born, I was left inside of a hospital for a couple of different reasons that I can only assume that she was not happy with the way that I was born, or maybe the way that I was conceived into this world. Many of you all don't know, if you follow me, or the new listeners that are on here, I've recently just found my biological father a year ago, and I posted and have been posting my experience about that. And I'm 33 years old now, so I'm just now having a parental relationship with a biological parent for the first time in my life. And so this is a very, very different and new experience for me, and I'm enjoying every minute of it. But let's just go back to, you know, me being born and just coming into this world, being left in the hospital, unbeknownst to me, and, you know, knowing that, you know, as an adult now, that I was left in the hospital, and another family member, my grandmother, had to come and get me out of the hospital because I was there too long. A lot of things for me, such as my birth certificate, such as my identity, just, you know, growing up with that orphan spirit, and just, you know, not being able to effectively heal because I was displaced at an early age, was very alarming growing up, because I had to grow up with those, with other people's ideas about me. You know what I mean? And so,
yes,
it was tough.
Niecy, let me kind of break in here and interject. You were born to an adolescent mother. How old was your mother when you were born?
So, from my understanding, my mother was 19 years old.
Okay. And she had been trafficked herself by some family members?
She was. And so my mother's sexual abuse started at 11 years old. So it was not her biological father, but it was her sister and brother's biological father who was sleeping with her from the age of 11 to 13.
Okay. And you said you called it sexual trafficking. Can you tell me why you defined it as trafficking? I think trafficking, people think, oh, you know, people are moving around the world and, you know, moving these kids, and that is part of it, but you can be trafficked in your own home.
Absolutely. The type of trafficking that my mother experienced was familial trafficking. And a lot of different reasons familial trafficking goes unnoticed, because people don't like to associate certain figures, such as a mother figure, a father figure, a aunt, a uncle. We have unperishable thoughts of family unity when you say father, mother, aunt, uncle. You don't want to ever, you know, abolish the thought of that being a welcoming group of people for any young child. You know what I mean? When you say aunt, you think, okay, that's my sister's sister. You know, that's my brother's sister. This person is family. And these titles help, you know, unfortunately, family members who are doing the trafficking go unnoticed, because people ignore that trafficking can happen because of who they are.
Right. And so familial trafficking, that is separate than what would you call like state-to-state or interstate trafficking or international trafficking. This is within a family. And I can relate to you, Dr. Hamilton. Let me first ask you, there's some background noise. I'm hearing some clicking. Is there something clicking in the background?
No, there shouldn't be anything clicking. This is, you might hear the AC, so maybe I'll turn it down. I'm not sure. How about now? Is that better?
Yes.
It's better? Okay, then it's definitely the AC. So let me turn it off this way. Okay. What about now?
Okay. So
good.
The story is very familiar to me because, you know, I was sexually abused by my mother's second husband from the age of 4 to 18, and I found out later in my 50s that she knew about it, that she knew he was a pedophile when she married him. So I was pretty much pimped to him for 14 years within my own home. Okay, so that was familial trafficking. And
absolutely.
I wouldn't have that term. Yes, I would not have that term if it wasn't for you right now. So you just taught me already on your show another form of, verbiage or way to terminology about trafficking. So I thank you for that.
Oh, no, you're most gracious.
Thank you. So I wanted to also ask, let's see, she left you in the hospital. She was 19. And does she live, did she have a place to live, or where was she, she wasn't stable, it sounds like.
From what I remember, we live in Haverstock Hill in Houston, Texas. And if anybody knows where Haverstock Hill is, it's Aldine Bender area. It's a really bad part of Harris County, and it's been infested with drugs and just, you know, communicable diseases such as HIV, and been a really, really bad place for a very long time, and it has not changed, even though times have changed. And we lived there for years. And at that time, my mother had already been introduced to crack cocaine by another family member, which was her mother's brother.
Right. So her substance abuse probably kept her from being a good mother to you, which caused you neglect. to be neglected.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So you said your grandmother, which was your paternal or maternal grandmother?
Maternal.
Maternal, your mother's mother, came and got you out of the hospital.
Yes.
Is that okay? How long did you live with her?
I stayed with her maybe until I was about 7 years old. And then from there, so CPS wasn't as big of an entity as it is today. Today, CPS operates like a fourth branch of government. And they shouldn't be, and they shouldn't have certain powers that they do have.
Absolutely.
But it's up to the parents.
That's a whole
other, you know,
show.
That is a whole nother show. Absolutely, fam. It is. But it's very important for parents to know their rights, that's for sure. But I remember some of my earliest experiences with CPS was about 7 years old, and always seeing the CPS worker, you know, come to the house or, you know, coming to check for me or my brother. I remember, growing up with the little brother, my brother had a speech impediment and he couldn't talk. And so he would just call me, "Hey, Yady." And so for a long time, I thought my name was Yady. Because I was like, he would just say, hey, Yady. I just
CPS,
didn't know.
Why was CPS coming to check on y'all?
Well, mainly because we were not in school, during the times that you were supposed to enroll your kids in school at the appropriate age. By the time we did get to school, we wasn't the right age.
Okay. So you're talking about truancy. Your grandmother didn't get you to school when you were supposed to be there, and they knew about...
Not my grandmother, but my mother.
Oh, your mother. So when you were seven, did you go live with your mother? Who did you live with at seven, from seven?
I wasn't living with my mother. I was living with my grandmother at seven. But this is the closest contact. That's the earliest time that I can remember.
Okay. But your mother was in and out of your life while you were with your grandmother?
Absolutely, because she had already been introduced to crack cocaine.
Okay. So what was your experience with you and your little brother and her being an addict? What was that experience like?
Oh, my. Well, definitely becoming an early cook was not in my mindset at that time, but I mean, we lived off of butter, sugar, and rice. That was the dream meal for us growing up. And really just always in a position to have to rescue my brother, because he had a speech impediment. He couldn't talk. He barely had clothes. He barely had anything that was representative of him being in existence or him, you know, just being a boy. You know, like, there were no boy clothes. So my brother would wear, like, my nighttime jammies, you know. So instead of him wearing jammies that were for boys, he would wear jammies that were for girls, you know, things like that. I remember my brother, you know, I think he had to have been about 3 or 4 years old. I remember CPS coming to knock at the door and, you know, saying that they were coming to pick he and I up. And he took off running. And when he took off running, he left me. He had a purple nightgown on. It had a cat on the front of it. And it was, you know, my jammies. But they were looking because, you know, we were not positioned the way normal children would be positioned had my mother not been on drugs or in and out of incarceration.
Okay. So was your grandmother able to make a stable life for y'all? It doesn't sound like he was able to, you know, just like, and I'm trying to understand, you know, that, yeah, your mother wasn't stable, but you were living with your grandmother. So why were y'all so poor living with your grandmother?
Well, it wasn't that we were poor. So my grandmother actually stayed in the same apartment as my mother did. So it was my mother, it was my grandmother, and then it was my aunt. And they just stayed in different sections of the apartments, but they were close. And whatever healing that my mother did not receive from her mother, you know, she was never in a place where she could formally say, you know, I'm ready to be a mother to my children, because her mother was never a mother to her.
Oh, okay.
So she didn't have experience. So for instance, so to make sure that the audience is kind of clear, if my grandmother is halfway involved, not halfway involved, but still trying to give her daughter the exposure and the experience to raising her own children, then she's not going to be as involved because she never was involved with her own daughter from the beginning. So if my mother, you know, you said what I said, but if my mother's in and out of jail, if she's, you know, back and forth doing drugs, things like that, to that nature, men are around. I remember one of her dealers that used to come around all the time, his name was Sugar Man. So I remember Sugar Man when he used to come to the house all the time to supply my mother with her, you know, fix and things like that. I remember, you know, having to hide in the bathroom all the time to stay away from my mom and Sugar Man when they would get high. And so just that right there alone, you know, if you're the mom or you're the sister, you know, you don't know when these things are happening. You just know that these things are happening. If, you know, my mom went to jail or she's gone for a certain amount of time, then who's coming to check up on me and my brother? Nobody. Do you see what I mean? There was no, there was no recourse. There was no, you know, we weren't considered important enough to be looked after or to be looked for, because we were Kim's kids. We were a crackhead mom children.
Oh, okay. So that was a whole different identity and time, and people just didn't really see you, it sounds like.
Right. And so that's why I was just kind of taking it slow through my birth era, you know, just coming here. I came here with an orphan spirit. I came here being left. And so the attitude of the family members in the house was that, well, you know, if you wasn't important for your mother to come and get you, then you're not going to be important now for us to come and get you too.
It didn't sound like that there were many stable people or knowledgeable people about caring for children in that day too. So,
absolutely. I was not the only person affected by the crack era. You know, there were several of us, but yes.
To when you were taken into foster care. Tell us why you were and what happened when you were taken into foster care starting at 14.
So actually I was considered aged out of foster care at 14. My first bat with foster care was at 7, and then I was actually taken into custody at age 11. And so I was taken into custody at that time because one of my downstairs neighbors from my grandmother's place of residence broke into her house and raped me. And when police was called and they were taking the statement, and they took my grandmother's statement and they took my statement, my grandmother, in her statement, she said that she no longer desired for me to live there. For her, because she was with her, because she was already on a fixed income, and that was too much for her. And so, you know, when you hear statements like that, it's like, okay, how do you move forward? And so the only other option from there is to go into foster care. Before actually reaching foster care, I went to CRC. It was called CRC back then. It was Chimney Rock Center. And so I actually lived in the shelter that they have in Houston for children for several months and moved to several different shelters after, because I think during that time we had Hurricane Alice
Allison, or maybe a Hurricane Ida. It was a hurricane up in there somewhere, and I was a little girl, and I remember we had to get moved around a lot because the CRC had flooded. But this was years ago.
Okay. I told you the first 30 minutes we're going to talk about you and a little bit about your survivor, okay? Now I'm going to get into – So we got a big picture, you know, and you're going to be telling your story later on a special guest night. But tonight is a professional survivor professional. So let's get into, if you don't mind, well, let's see, go down the panel and see if anybody has any questions.
Yes, before we bring on my guest, does anybody have any questions?
Sure. Right. Mark, do you have a question for Dr. Nisi or a comment?
Sure. When you finally got into school, you know, a lot of survivors make the statement that that was their safe haven from their home. Was that for you the same thing? Did you go to school? Did you excel in things that you really liked? You found peace of mind when you were at school? Or how did that go for you?
Absolutely, I found peace of mind when I was at school. Probably the reason why I'm still in school, because when you're at school, you can eat when you're at school, and you make friends when you're at school, and you get to operate differently. You get to have relationships, and the value of relationships go up when you're at school. And so, and then relationships stop becoming a hindrance to you when you're at school. Aside from the bullying, you still have your teachers and you have your friends, and, you know, you have, you know, the 3 o'clock news when your best friend's whispering in your ear about, you know, who's going to go to such and such birthday party that weekend, you know, things like that, where you can escape mentally from the abuse that's going on at home.
Yes. But did you get into any kind of sports at all as well? Or?
I did, actually, in the eighth grade. I was number one in my school. I went into Sharpstown Middle School when I was in foster care. So shout out to all of my teachers that I still keep in touch with. Actually, that still keep in touch with me, Mr. Ade and Ms. Kelly King. They're still teachers. And that's the last, like, really good memories of high school that I remember. But I did. I actually played football in the eighth grade. I played football, basketball, volleyball. I was a big sportsman in school. And ended up with graduating, like, that class with the highest athleticism during that time, and as well as my grade point average being high. So math and science was my thing, and I was like, oh, school is going to be my ticket out of all of this drama. You just wait and see. So I was very focused. No, I was just saying, and I had to, because I officially didn't start school till second grade. So that's the last time I remember, like, just being in school. So, like, pre-K, kindergarten, first grade, I didn't see any of those grades.
How do you feel now about that when you look back on it? What are your feelings about that?
I don't know. You know, so my husband today is, he helped me with those memories a lot, because we've been knowing each other since the second grade. And I remember, I still remember our third grade teacher, which was, you know, Ms. Johnson, and really just having those memories of, you know, people, of just growing up and having a relationship with other people's moms. And, the best thing I remember about it is just, like, having a field day and cakewalk. Like, when I think about those memories, I don't even think about the pre-K, the kindergarten, the first grade part. I'm actually kind of happy that if I got to skip through all of that and I still made it, it's like, okay, I did a very good job.
I worked very hard through that. So Hooked on Phonics was my best friend when I was growing up. So I had a little.
We have somebody that just joined us from Minnesota. Her name is Victoria Kelly. She's one of our ambassadors here at NASCA, one of our family members. Niecy, I'd like to introduce you to Victoria.
Hi, Victoria. How's it going?
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm on a little bit late today because I go to a Zoom meeting on Thursday night. So, but I happened to see that the link, you know, for the new group host or whatever, and I want to come on and support you.
Oh, thank you, Victoria. This feels so good. I'm excited. I'm so excited. You have no idea, and I'm really excited for my guest that I'm getting ready to bring on my first show. So this is super, super duper exciting day for me right now.
Oh, fantastic. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
I appreciate when people step up, you know, and you know, become a participant because, you know, it's really important for survivors to have some place to go.
That's true. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Victoria. We're going to be talking back and forth a lot. We've got an hour left. The show goes by very fast. I told you, Dr. Niecy. But I want to tell Dr. Niecy Ladera Karn, C-A-R-N, Ladera Karn, just PM'd me. He said, wow, Niecy was once on my board, and we did the NAACP as experts in our field. Hers was sex trafficking, and mine was domestic violence. Congratulations, Niecy.
Oh, yes, Dr. Purpose. Hey, shout out to you, Dr. Purpose. Thank you so much for coming on. God bless you.
Yeah. Well, she's not on in the studio. She just sent me a private message to shout out to you.
Okay, awesome. I'll take that too.
Okay, so we're here tonight introducing Dr. Niecy Hamilton, just to recap a little bit from the start of the show. She does have somebody she wants to introduce in just a few minutes that works with her. Dr. Niecy Hamilton, she is a survivor of a survivor of neglect and abandonment by her mother, and she was raped at a young age, but she's also now a professional. Tell us about your professionalism. What do you do as a professional to help with survivors, any kind of survivors?
Awesome. So I am a motivational speaker, and I'm also a coach. So I coach women into just out of that transition of what to do next. How do I turn my painful experience into something that's going to empower the next generation or even their own children? I had a 7-year battle, which we'll get to that when we actually talk on the show that you're going to bring me on, a 7-year battle without having my children and my children themselves going into foster care. And I, you know, the only thing I could think of is this is the same thing that happened to my brother and I when we were children, and I got to do something about it, you know. And I mean, just that mama bear kicked up in me, and, I was a mama bear for 7 years and fighting for my children, and I talked about my children. I talked to my children. I wrote letters to my children every single day. Was, you know, just a different battle for me dealing with that, you know, losing my children the way that I lost my children and then having to go and get them back out of custody because my children were made to live and be raised by my traffickers. And that was
good.
You know, that's a whole nother story within itself. But, it was just so much that now I take out the time to teach women and men everything it is that I know about the family court. Family court, everything it is I know about criminal courts, everything it is that I know about CPS, how it works, what are the instruments, what are the tools and techniques, how do you fight back, how do you keep your mind and move forward, and things like that. So that's very, very important to me. And it's very important for mothers and fathers to have a strategic position when it's time to fight for your children back, when it's time to fight for your generation, because you don't want to leave anything open. You don't want to be vulnerable to anything, because things will happen to your grandchildren if you don't correct it in the time that it happened. And so, you know, that's a big, big thing. And it's very important to me. It's dear to my heart. So I do it all the time, and I'm grateful for it.
Dr. Nietzsche, that's amazing. But I want to ask you one question as you talk about that. Do you know that the CPS family court system is a business model?
Absolutely. Oh, God.
And it's
a
multi-billion-dollar industry.
Yes, it is. A lot of the trafficking comes out of there, you know, to our children, our underprivileged children, as well as children. And I got to say this to my white people that aren't here. Y'all know that I love y'all. You know, I will say this. They sell more white children. And when I say sell, I mean that. They sell more white children than they do black children. And mainly because it's very hard to find, you know, just clean white child. You know, it's like if there's ever an opportunity, it's like you got blonde hair, you know, white skin, blue eyes. Oh, we will quickly give you away and put you into the adoption phase before we ever consider the mother being in a position to raise their child or being in a position to, you know, go through that CPS process where they can have their children and, you know, be a fit mother, you know, around their children. They'll give a white baby to an adoption agency quicker than they would a black baby back to their mother.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I'm not too familiar with that level of racism or with that level of just being inhumane. I've never
okay.
seen a system that doesn't, you know, we hear second chance, second chance, second chance all the time. And then we hear opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. And you got to think, is CPS here for second chance people, or are they here to give parents opportunities to correct wrongdoing? Okay. And so it's not so much that parents need second chances, parents need opportunities. And so we have to change the way we look at that value system. I don't understand why wouldn't a white child be returned to their white mother the same way a black child would be returned to their black mother. That bothers me, because I think that if you could take out the time to understand the black mother and give the kid back, then you should do the same thing with white babies. But it doesn't happen that way. And so that's the reason why I say sell. Because if they're up for adoption, that's selling. We see this happen all the time. You know, one of my very, very good friends right now, you know, fighting very hard in the system to get her baby back, Jessica Yeager. My friend is my sister. She is such a survivor. And, you know, very same thing happened to a beautiful white girl, blue eyes, blonde hair. And as she was going through the CPS process to get her baby back, decisions were made behind her back. And she was forced in this position, you know, without anybody being there to help her. She didn't, you know, there was no counsel. There was nothing. And that's not right. That's inhumane.
Yeah,
let me
ask you this question, because it's not only a race, you know, between white and black or Hispanic or what have you, Asian. It's more, it's because it's a business industry, it's also classism. It's also socioeconomic.
Absolutely.
Mother, yeah, I'm in contact with some women who had money and they went after their money, taking their children away, you know, and they had to fight getting their children back in the courts. And the children were given to the abuser,
And, you know, the mother never got, they bankrupted the mother, and they're still fighting to get their children back, but they have no money. And, you know, the children are still with the abuser. And that's, you know, that's a whole other topic, which is very, very
interesting.
It is.
And
it goes
deep. You guys. Man,
this is Victoria. Could I join in?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that my kids were in and out of foster homes because I was in like a revolving door psych unit, and this one family. Okay, so I'll just preface this that my daughter was white and. Blue eyes, blonde hair. My son was white with a little bit darker skin and brown eyes and blue and brown hair. I can't even say it right. I'm just kind of pissed off about what happened. And the family, this one certain family had them, and the social worker tried to adopt them out from under me. And, you know, I was really working hard and stuff on, you know, getting my life together and stuff after abuse. And she came straight out and said, I really think that you should, you know, sign the papers to give up your children because you're poor and these people have money.
My God.
You know, and I said, literally said, you can't take away my kids because I'm poor.
Right. And yeah. that is totally, totally illegal. And, you know,
and I won, but what if I hadn't? And I thought,
right.
Yeah, well, you know,
right.
My kids would have a better life. You know.
That is so true. And, I'm so sorry that you had that experience. And that's what I'm here for. Just to navigate people through those experiences. I mean, because I don't think people know how much money actually goes into search and rescue. You know, when your kid actually goes missing, what happens when you actually make the first police report, when you make police reports for human trafficking, you know, why the CPS get involved, the police offices or police stations that are actually working with CPS, because CPS isn't everywhere all the time. A lot of their reports come from the police officers. So, you know, for instance, if somebody's reporting something on, even if the parent, let's say the parents report, hey, my kid's missing, hey, you know, there's been a report of sexual abuse or whatever, that officer takes that information down. But, you know, because they're considered first responders for child abuse, then they also report that to CPS. And so here it is, we have two reporting agencies dealing with one issue, and one of them is supposed to be a savior that they pay taxes to actually help serve and protect. But the other one is acting, treating the parent as if they're a criminal.
Yeah.
And it confuses people. And I have to go back and sit up and teach people, hey, you have inalienable rights. This
yeah,
is not
and
how
in,
this
in
goes.
92, they didn't have anybody to help you navigate the system. You know, I mean, there was like nobody that you could connect with that you could say, hey, you know, this is going on. Could somebody give me some support to keep my children? You know, I mean, there was like nothing out there. Now there's a lot of connections people can make to get support from other people and organizations. But back in 92, I felt like so alone.
Right. My. And I mean, and don't get me wrong. I mean, it wasn't just 92. You know, in the 2000s, people felt alone. Still in 2021, people still feel alone because they shouldn't be pressured to financially fund any type of, you know, organism that is putting such a strain on the already fiscally strained economy within, especially like already disadvantaged people, you know. None of it is correct, and that doesn't matter what color you are. It don't matter if you're white, black, Hispanic, Asian.
No.
You know, it's already stressed. It's already strained, and things like that. But you know, I don't think people should be losing their kids over certain things because they didn't have the opportunity. You know, if you're gonna be in the place of healing families and making sure that families are restored and rebuilt, and you know, are, can function together and heal together. You know, that's the whole reason why we are doing this show on NASCA. This is the whole reason why we're talking about stop child abuse. You know, we have to be responsible for understanding why corporations such as CPS don't feel like they should, you know, be corporately social or operating corporate social responsibility when it comes down to the healing process. They actually do the opposite, and it shouldn't be that way.
Well, we moved out of the county shortly after that. You know, I fought back. We moved out of the county, and I moved to a different county and got this excellent social worker. And he got so many services that it was just unbelievable and was very supportive. And, it was like night and day.
Yeah, and I don't think anything. And let me just say this: I'm not against CPS. What I'm against is, you know, people not being able to do thorough investigations because one CPS worker can have like 75 caseloads. That's what I'm against. If the organization doesn't have a support system, then why do I have to rely on your ideas for fixing my family if you're not even supported by your own job? That doesn't work. And it doesn't make sense. So I'm already knowing that going into this contract, and parents, listen to me, do not get into a contract with these people. All that, you know, that safety plan, when you sign a safety plan, that is a contract. Never sign a contract with the government that allows them to come in and out of your house because you have inalienable rights. You can say no to those things. And you should always, always, always get an attorney to fight that battle. Don't you fight that battle on your own. Don't you ever deal with anybody that says that they work for a governmental entity. I don't care if it's the police. I don't care if it's Homeland Security. I don't care if it's CPS. I don't care if it's a CPS worker. I don't care if it's a school. Always get an attorney, and you have somebody to help you navigate or call an advocate. And that's what I'm here for.
Right.
You call a professional, you call an advocate to help you navigate through that, because this is all about healing families at the source of abuse and to stopping it. And if you're going to – here's the thing. I might not personally be putting my child in an abusive situation. The surrounding of my child may be an abusive situation, and I may just need an opportunity to get out. But I don't know that, okay? I don't know that. I might need help. I might be on some ride or die, hustle type mentality, which if you're a real mother, and I know there's some real mothers on this call, you've been in a position or you've been in a situation where you've just like, look, we got to stick it through it. We got to suck this up. We got to, you know, force our way through this right here until things just get a little bit better, until I get over the hump, you know, so that everything can get better. But that doesn't mean that mom doesn't deserve to raise their kid or keep their kid. And we're not talking about sexual abuse or physical abuse or staying in abusive relationships. I am against that. I'm against all forms of abuse. That is never okay. But still, even in those situations, those women still need those opportunities. And if the ecosystem of that household is governed by a one person's income, which is typically the man, and she doesn't work, or she hasn't gone to school, she's not in a position to where she can move forward successfully with income that can support her and two children, her and three children, her and upwards to four and five children, then that mother's going to feel like she's forced to keep taking the abuse, even though it's unhealthy for the children. But at least they have hot water. At least they have AC. At least they have a bed. Even if they don't have a bed, at least I have a floor. And there are some women that are just stuck in those situations like that. Even with that, a governmental entity shouldn't have to come in and say, you know, hey, we're going to help you manage your conflict, but while we're managing your conflict, we're going to remove your children, place them in the house with somebody that they do not know. Okay, this is trauma. We're going to re-traumatize them. Okay, put them in the house with somebody they do not know, and we're going to hope they have a better experience while living with six other kids that have all come from abusive backgrounds as well, with somebody who's just taking the kids in so they can collect the check. Somewhere somebody's got to say, okay, either we're disillusioned or we're crazy to think that.
So I have a question for you. Okay, so in my situation, I pretty much called self-protection on myself, you know, because I felt that I might be abusive, because back when I got away from my dad in 1983, they made me go to a support group for incest survivors. And at that time, they said 85% of the parents who have survived incest will abuse their children. And I bought that hook, line, and sinker, you know, which isn't true, but I guess the statistics they had were probably from the people that had went through the court system. And there's many people that are survivors of incest that never revealed they were incest survivors and never abused their children, you know, but I
right.
guess the ones that went through the court system and the statistics were like insane. So it scared me, and I thought I might, you know, hurt my kids. And so that thought was kind of planted in, you know, seed planted in my brain. And like you said, you know, so they, you know, they came in and they were like, well, we have to put together a plan and you have to pretty much sign it. And, you know, like you said, don't sign anything. Well, I was scared to death that, you know, if I didn't sign this plan of, you know, how I was going to go about, you know, and then they sent me to all these groups and it
right.
was just
okay, so
constant.
Let's start right there, because I know exactly what that process is. So let's just go back. So you felt some type of guilt, shame, hurt. Typically, that is what people feel who've already been abused, right? And so you felt like, look, let me take it upon myself to correct any type of abuse before it starts with me, because I saw what happened, you know, 20 years ago when somebody didn't correct it when it happened to me. I don't want to be that person with, you know, with my children or with my own grandchildren, right? So you decided to call CPS on yourself. Okay, so let me tell you something. There's a thing in the Constitution called your Fifth Amendment. And that Fifth Amendment clearly states that it is against the law for you to tell on yourself. It's against the law for you to snitch on yourself, tell on yourself to do anything that will put you in a position where you couldn't hire an attorney manage your conflict for you. So that's number one, because you should never be in a position where you're practicing violating your own rights. Okay, and that's something that I have to talk to black people time and time and time and time again. And it isn't just black people. It's anybody who just don't understand that level of the law to the T, right? Because something that could have been managed with therapy, you wanted the government to manage. And this is a whole beef with, you know, with different political parties. Some political parties feel like the government should have more control, where other political parties feel like they shouldn't. You understand what I'm saying? That tug of war is for. And so let's travel down memory lane. So then you said, okay, well, here it is. I tell on myself. Somebody should have been able to evaluate that. Hey, I might just need, you know, access or an opportunity for therapy. That opportunity and access to therapy, right? Because they're supposed to act as a resource to you, turns into somebody wanted to do a psych eval on you, and before they can even get to the psych eval part, you had to sign a legal document, a safety plan, a contract for them to come in to invade your life. So, and what that does is it gives them access to know more about you than they should. And see, you didn't need anybody evaluating everything that you went through. You were just trying to take precaution on anything that could have happened, because you were just being careful because you care. Now, you in a normal, great, perfect world, what you did would be considered super awesome. But we don't live in that world where we can depend on the government to help us manage conflict, because they're not there yet. Neither do they have the manpower. Do you not know in Houston alone, still behind about 4,500 officers? How the city of Houston is managing the conflict is amazing to me. It is the
Houston, you know, I have to clap my hands up for Houston. They, you know, our numbers in crime, they've gone up in a lot of different places because of COVID. But, you know, we are running circles around some of these cities whose you know, crime rate has gone up tremendously. Right now, the city of Houston's biggest issue is bail reform and dealing with who gets to get, you know, bonds once you're actually found out that you're a criminal. And that sucks. But here it is. CPS treats parents who actually just want to be good parents or who actually just need opportunity like they're criminals before they even get the chance to, you know, be expressive about their parental ideas or their parental style Dr. or what it is they would like to do. Sometimes they just want to be heard.
Yeah. Dr. Nakit.
Well, I was in and out of a revolving door of psychiatric units.
Hello.
And I had the place.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello, Pamela. I want to interject right now. I wanted to say that, you know, CPS, that they're not about, because they want to make money, okay? They've got to keep their jobs, okay? Government people are pretty much about keeping their jobs, right? Just like even the political realm, which we don't get into here. We don't get into issues, any kind of political issues or anything like that. But just like the people that represent us in the state and the Senate, they don't care about the people. They care about their jobs, okay? So that's what most of this is all about, coming down to a nutshell. So, yeah, I think we've talked enough about this right now. And Dr. Nisi, I want to have time because we've got only 30 minutes left to give out your information for people that are listening in to hear that you know how to navigate this and that they can contact you. But we don't give any advice to people as far as saying you should sign or you shouldn't sign. I mean, you know, we can't do that because we're an organization and we can help be held liable for, you know, say somebody doesn't sign something and it would have helped them if they did. Well, that can come back on us. So we've got to be very careful about giving advice. So let's move on in the show if you would like to, Dr. Nisi. And you wanted to bring on your partner there.
Yes, I did. So let me see if I can get Shakira. I think she's over. She just walked over to another station. But you know what? I'm going to get her on as soon as she come out so that we can kind of talk to her and get her story.
Okay. Can you tell us how to contact you, what your Facebook, your, you know, where you are to be contacted for, as a motivational speaker and as a coach to help people like your, you know, like what you went through and like what Victoria went through to help them navigate the system if they're stuck in it, you know?
Absolutely. So you guys can find me at www.safespacetraining.net. That's SAFE space SPACE training.net. That's all one word. You guys can also email me, please, nisi@yahoo.com. And my Facebook is just Nisi Hamilton, hashtag I Survived Human Trafficking. You guys can also feel free to send me friend requests. I'm on Instagram at @TheReal_NisiHamilton. I'm on Twitter at @HamiltonNisi. And I'm just happy to serve you guys and to make sure that we're, you know, that we're going in the right direction and that we're empowered and that we feel confident about surviving child abuse and raising our children and being confident in raising our children, being confident in not becoming abusers. Because let me tell you, when you don't deal with the abuse, you're at risk of becoming an abuser. It's not when you're trying to deal with the abuse. And so we have to just change the mindset. And I'm so happy for our guest that was talking, Miss Victoria. She sounds like she's a wonderful mother. And, you know, I'm really grateful for her heart, for her spirit, and for her story and, you know, what transpired in her life and that she survived that.
Yes, and while we're waiting for your sidekick there, let's go back to Victoria and see if she had a question. She wanted one more question, Victoria, if you have it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say quick that the second social worker I got was very supportive, but I was in like revolving door of psych wards like every 3 months I was going in, and I realized I wasn't being the mother that I wanted to be or that my kids needed. And that social worker helped me place my kids into wonderful foster homes. But I gave my physical rights, but not my legal rights. So I still had visitation. I still had, you know, say about a lot of things that happened with my children. And, you know, it was the hardest decision I ever made, but it was the best. And the other thing is I tried to tell the first social worker I thought my kids were being sexually abused. And her response to that was that it was transference, that because I was abused, I thought my kids were. And I found out later on when I was going to therapy with my kids when they were in foster care and stuff that my son felt safe enough and my daughter, too, to tell me that, yes, they had been. And, you know, I think, you know, like I said, it was the hardest thing I ever did. Kids are very, very emotionally and financially and physically secure today. And I wouldn't have done it any other way because my kids would not be where they are today if it wasn't for, you know, the foster cares they were in and that were good. You know, I mean, so, you know, a lot of people will say how bad the foster care system is, but you know, I just want to speak out, too, that there are good foster homes out there and there are good social workers.
Oh,
right.
Absolutely. Victoria.
And I'm grateful.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me say something to Victoria before I get back to you, Dr. Nisi. Victoria, did your children have to have help getting over the sexual abuse or the, I don't know what kind of abuse it was, whatever kind of abuse they had to deal with?
Well, my,
did they have to
when I found out
profession?
Yeah, when I found out about my son, he was still living with me, and I got him to a psychologist. They diagnosed him with ADHD and PTSD, but he was seeing a psychiatrist that put him on Ritalin, and the Ritalin made him psychotic, so they started putting him on psychotic medication. And before he went into foster care, he went into this place for kids that had behavior problems. And when he walked in the door, he said, I don't want to be on these meds. And they said, okay, you don't have to be, but if you do something that, you know, is against the rules or whatever, you got to write down what happened, what you did, and what could have done differently. And then he went into the foster home, and they got him mainstreamed into regular school because he was in a special school with kids with behavior problems. And they just were very stable and, you know, gave him the stability he needed, which I couldn't give him. And but he did go through some, you know, some therapy with a psychologist who was wonderful, who worked with children that had been sexually abused. Yeah, and he was a different kid after
that. That's wonderful, Victoria. And
that
I can't imagine
wonderful.
How you feel. Yeah, I can't imagine how you feel as a survivor yourself, having your child being a survivor. I can't imagine that feeling. Yeah.
It was so hard because I was working in the battered women's, you know, movement and sexual assault movement. And I knew the signs of a child that had been abused and trying to tell the social worker and then having them come back and say, no, I'm just transferring my story onto them was just so discounting.
Wow. Yeah, well, we're gonna have naysayers, aren't we, Dr. Nisi?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to.
And we need to listen. We need to go to each other who can be supportive. I heard it said by one survivor that she never felt validated until she told her story to another survivor. And that's it. Survivors, you know one another. They know each other's story without telling it, you know, because it's our feelings, our emotions, our, you know, our physical bodies, you know, our souls. I mean, we're all the same when it comes to that kind of childhood trauma, right?
That is so right.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry about that noise in the background. You just heard my guest walk in. So she is here now.
Okay, you want to introduce her?
Absolutely, I do. You guys, once again, going into the last piece of our segment, welcome to the Niecy Hampton Show on the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. So put your comfort in a box and move it to the side, and let's talk about things that are uncomfortable to talk about. You are talking to a professional survivor leader, Niecy Hamilton, and I am a survivor of labor and human trafficking as a child and adult. So I need y'all to do me a favor. Reach out to your family, your friends, your neighbors, your cousins, your sisters and brothers for this next guest that I'm getting ready to bring on today on my first show. I had a discussion last week with a very good friend of mine. Her name is Evangelist Shakira McFadden, and we were talking about childhood abuse. And her story is so powerful and so impactful. She was sexually abused by her brother at a young age. She was on drugs. She sold drugs. And, you know, in and out of incarceration, she was, you know, she did get married and things like that, and her husband participated with her. She used to commit fraud. I mean, there was just so much that was happening to her and through her because of what had happened to her as a child, and those issues never being resolved, and that hurt and that anger turned into a lifetime of terror for her, because not only was she terrorized as a child, she became a terrorist herself. And I really want to talk about how she overcame that, who she is today, and just the proud woman that I am of her today, because she is a total sister to me and a survivor of child sexual abuse. And I want you guys to give a warm welcome to my friend, Shakira McFadden.
Hello, hello. How are you guys?
We're doing good.
Great. So thank you for having me on. That's the first thing I want to say. I just want to just give a little, you know, quick summary of my life and what I went through. So at a young age, my brother, he took my virginity. My mother was a great mom. She just drunk clubbed a lot. So because she chose the clubs and partying, you know, over her children, she worked for Publix 30 years. She provided, but she just never was home at night. It was work, and then she came home partying and things like that with her friends. So one night it was me and my two sisters that were younger than me home, and my older brother was watching us, and he knew I was infatuated with his video game. And he woke me up in the middle of the night. I'll never forget. It was about 2-something in the morning, and he said, Mom is going out to the club or to party with her friends. So he asked me, did I want to play the video game? He's like, you can stay up later. Come play the video game. And I stated to him, yes, I wanted to play the video game. And as I got into the room with him, every time I would play with the video game, he would snatch the remote control back from me. And then I would be like, okay, well, I'm going to go lay down. And then he'll give it back to me and say, I'm just kidding. And that went on about 2 or 3 times until, you know, the fourth time where he, you know, laid on top of me and forced himself inside of me as I screamed. I'll never forget, I got on a white T-shirt and Little Mermaid underwear. And I remember just bleeding and crying, not understanding why, not understanding what was going on, because my brother was supposed to be the protector. He was the one that my mom, you know, left in charge. And I remember just going in the bathroom after him saying to me he would kill me and rape our other two younger sisters if I said anything. So I remember going in the bathroom and crying and bleeding while sitting in the tub. And after that, I remember going in the kitchen and grabbing a knife and laying next to our two younger sisters and stating if he did it to them, I would kill him. So the next day, my mom ended up coming home, I want to say 5-6 o'clock that morning, and I wanted to just tell her so bad, but I was worried about him doing it again or her not believing me or him doing it, you know, to our other sisters. My father I was in and out of federal prison all of my life. He taught me how to cook and sell drugs at 8 years old. So when I was going to school with other younger people who were going to school and they were hearing their drug abuse resistance education and being taught the importance of not using drugs and selling drugs, I was home being taught how to sell drugs. And I remember saying to my dad, like, why are you teaching me this at a such a young age? And he said, I never want you to get to a place where you have to lay on your back and sleep with men for money. So my childhood just was a little bit different. Still holding on to the fact that I was molested by my brother and raped. I began to use not having an outlet to talk to anyone as a way of anger. So I turned to drugs. I got high and I got drunk to cover the pain, when in reality, it just covered the pain temporarily. So I began to date women and slept with all kind of women, over 100 at least. I don't even remember their names. And I just began to have threesomes with other guys and things like that with other women. And as I would begin to do that, I just, you know, just use that as a way to numb the pain. And as a way to numb the pain, I began to target other women who were virgins and begin to just tell them I love them and use them so I can do the same thing. I wanted to take their virginity with sexual toys. So I didn't love them. I didn't care about them. But I just wanted to take something from them that was took from me. So as I got older, I just turned to the streets. I'm using drugs, selling drugs, doing fraud, having threesomes, partying, using drugs to where I just didn't care. And I held on to the hurt for a while. And my mom, another thing was she passed, I want to say 2 years after. So dad was in and out of federal prison. Then I no longer had a mom, so the streets began to raise me. So where normal children would have a normal life, I had to be the provider for my younger sisters. To where normal children would have a normal life, I was walking outside and seeing one of my friend's brains blown out with a gun. I was walking outside, stepping on crack pipes, and, you know, it just was a way of living. So after being incarcerated the last time I went, because I have 22 mug shots, so jail became a revolving door for me. And the last time I went, I was supposed to get 15 years. And the judge ended up giving me another chance after sitting in there 2 years. And I decided to come out and just change my life. I received Christ while I was incarcerated. And I came out and changed my life and just started telling other people that there's a different type of natural high out there, and that's Jesus. I changed my life. I started going back inside the jails and prisons. I'm in ministering to people on death row, ministering to all kind of people. I started telling my story, telling people to release the pain because someone else is going through something you've already conquered. So I started telling myself I was beautiful. I started telling myself it wasn't my fault. I became an author. I had other outlets. I started feeding the homeless and doing things for the broken and just things like that, and, you know, just use it as an outlet to turn my life around. So I realized that drugs and alcohol, that was just a temporary way to numb the pain. You got to open your mouth and talk about it. You got to get with other people who can encourage you to keep pushing. You got to know that it's not your fault. You know, you said no, and you got to realize that your past is your past for a reason. So you don't want to become, you know, a victim, but a victor. So that's what I did.
Oh, that's an amazing story. Yeah, powerful. I want to bring on Penelope. Penelope, you heard Shakira. What do you have to say to Shakira?
Oh, my gosh. First of all, I'm just sending you a big hug from the state
Thank
of
you.
Washington right now and let you know that what you are and how far you've come, you know, just the recognition of seeking the truth of what happened to you as a little girl to the manifestations of that, to how you cope with it, how you numbed yourself, and then how you recognize that and what you did to turn it around. I mean, that is the embodiment of hope. It really embodies hope. And just it's just the beauty and healing them, and it gives. I feel when I think about my own story, I was thinking a lot about my own story as you were speaking. It's inspiring because you know healing is not an easy process; it's painful. And there's something about when you said your Little Mermaid underwear that really just I don't know, cut my heart, right? Like a knife went through my heart because
right.
The innocence, you know. We lose our innocence, you know, we have this death of our innocence and how there's, we go through the grieving process and a lot of it is, you know, numbing and destructive behaviors, but that you can still
right.
move forward with your life no matter what. And that's
yes.
what you just told us about and you described. And that is, you know, to me, that is the beauty and healing and the hope,
yes.
right? The hope. That just hearing your voice right now and where you're at, you know, horrible
yes.
things happen to us in life that are not our fault. We didn't make the mess, but
yes.
we have the power to clean it up. And that's what you just, that you're a testament to that. So I'm so glad I was able to call in. I got at my meeting at work late, but I felt like I called at the right time to hear your entire story. And I, like I said, I'm just sending you all the love there is.
And another thing, I just want to leave everyone with this who's listening. Sometimes it might not be your fault, but it's your fight. So sometimes you're going to go through things that you have no control of, things that will teach you perseverance, things that are placed there to teach you strength so you can be strength to others. So it may not be your fault, but it's your fight. And because I fought through it, I can now tell somebody else, listen, you can't be a survivor after this. You surviving is just teaching you strength. So I just want to leave you guys with that. And you can follow me. I'm on Facebook at Shakira McFadden and YouTube, Shakira McFadden, to see all the inspiration. But if nothing else, you caught hold on to that I spoke today, just remember, things will come your way in life, and it's not your fault, but it's your fight. So we don't ask for some of the things that happen to us, but we got to fight our way back out of it. Depression is not an option. Feeling broken is not an option. You know, feeling alone, it's not an option because our future is much brighter.
Shakira.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Shakira.
Yep.
Tell the audience what you told me earlier about the rearview mirror.
Yes. So what I was explaining to her is this is why our rearview mirror is much smaller than our front windshield, because what's behind you is small to where your future is, what your future is becoming. It's greater ahead of you. So we have to get to a place where we stop looking behind us. You know, we have to deal with, you know, the child within us and the things we went through and move on. Because, you know, life doesn't owe you anything. People don't owe you anything in life. So a lot of people, they never become overcomers because they're still holding on to what's behind them instead of making a greatness out of what's in front of them. So this is why our rearview mirror is much smaller than our front windshield.
So let me ask you this. Say somebody is seeing their rearview mirror bigger. What should they do to make it look smaller and continue to, you know, only see the rearview mirror smaller or seeing it big?
If they're seeing their rearview mirror smaller, they need to about face. That means they're facing the wrong direction. They're stuck on and they're holding on to their past. But at some point, you have to outgrow it. So I would say turn around. I would say look for outlets. Sometimes just writing is an outlet. Writing to yourself. I sat inside that cell years, plenty of times, just writing in a small room with other women, just crying, not understanding how we got where we are. But I began to write. I was writing God every day, and I was telling him, I don't even know who you are. I don't know who you are. You're someone I heard about, but I want to get to know who you are. It's vitally important also to change your circle. The people you're connected to, you want to be connected to people who can uplift you and inspire you and bring you out of your dark days, who can remind you that, you know, you don't have to be depressed. You can have joy. It's okay to smile. You add years to your life by smiling. It's depression. It's hurt. It's brokenness. It's feeling overwhelmed. That kills you the quickest. Stress. So, you know, to just smile is enough. You got to speak to yourself and tell yourself everything is going to be okay, even when you don't feel okay. And sometimes you got to be okay with not getting an apology you deserve, even if it's from mothers, fathers. You have to move on. Some people are stuck there. So if they are looking and seeing their rearview mirror bigger, I would say the same way they say in the Army about faith. You're facing the wrong direction.
Cool.
What's in front of you is greater than what's behind you.
That's awesome. Thank you for coming on and sharing that
with us.
Thank you. We have 9 minutes left. Is Dr. Nacy there?
Yes, I am here. You guys just heard from a survivor yourself, evangelist Shakira McFadden, who is so awesome and amazing. Her testimony was super, and thank you so much to the great state of Washington for showing her love, for coming on to support. I am very, very happy. Today, guys, we just learned how to manage the conflict of sexual abuse when it comes from a family member, and that couldn't be of a much more important topic, because a lot of times the abuse is coming from a family member. We started the show off talking about my mother's trauma and abuse coming from, you know, somebody who should have been considered a family member, Ms. Pam, coming to the realization that she was familiar trafficked. My mother was familiar trafficked. And then in Shakira's case, that was just sexual assault, not trafficking. No one actually knew what happened to her. And so nobody acted as a pimp in that situation. It was just two people involvement. But you guys, I hope, you know, my hope is that the awareness level goes up, that the way you think about sexual assault, the way you think about human trafficking, the way you think about online solicitation, the way you see family members, I hope that this awareness goes up. Stop thinking that just because he's the father to your children that he may not be perverted. That's not true. Stop thinking that just because that's the mother to your children that she may not be perverted, or that that's an aunt or an uncle or a cousin. Or in Shakira's very chilling story, her very own brother who took her virginity away from her. And that, you know, my heart goes out to her. But she survived that, and she's an overcomer, and I'm extremely happy and proud to know her today.
Me too. Thank you so much for bringing Shakira on. I want to reach out to her to tell her story on a special guest night. But thank you for introducing her to us on this topic night. And do you want to just whatever you want to do, Miss? Dr. Nacy, we've got 5 minutes. Do you want to just talk to the audience a little bit? Do you have a question or a topic you want to bring up?
Let's talk to the audience. Does anybody in the audience have any questions or anything, anything anybody's dealing with? And please, you guys, leave the details off of the radio. Please email me, Nacy, NISSI.Hamilton. @yahoo.com for any details, any type of chilling stories that you may want to
talk about, but they have a legal nature to them. And then we'll go through that and get you guys ready, because I know some people are, you know, ready to tell their stories and ready to move forward out of the cycle of abuse because of strongholds and hindrances.
I would just ask Dr. Naska and all the people listening to continue to go over the website and see what all we have to offer. As from Naska, we have three recovery groups. They're Zoom meetings 3 times a week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday, and they're at 2 o'clock Eastern. They're for an hour and a half. And I just want to thank you, Dr. Nisi, for accepting the fourth Thursday of every month to come on and be our survivor professional and field the questions from the audience and people that are going to get to know you. And thank you for telling your story. And, you know, I can't thank you enough.
Oh, man, not a problem, Ms. Pam. And I want to send a special thank you to Ms. Victoria for coming on with me. She had to leave, and I'm sorry that she had to leave. And she was an amazing special guest of my special guest, which is Ms. Pam and Shakira. And she did wonderful, and I'm so glad that she was able to, you know, talk about her story and talk through her story and things like that. She has an amazing story, too. She was also a victim of sex trafficking, and she was sold and kidnapped by 3 different pimps, raped at least 8 times a night.
Who are you talking about? Who are you talking about?
Miss Victoria.
Who? Oh,
Miss Victoria.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, she's coming on to tell her story again in June, I believe, or May. I can't remember. I'll have to. She's coming on soon to tell her story again, so I'll have to let you know when. Okay?
Yes, please do. She has an amazing story.
Okay. So let me see. Mark, do you have anything to say before we go?
I just wanted to thank Dr. Nisi for coming on and fielding questions. And let me tell you, there's a lot of people out there that need your expertise, you know, navigating through the system. Because we hear, you know, quite a few stories where, you know, people are having trouble. You know, they're being sucked dry and they want their kids back. So I think, you know, this is a good thing that you're showing what you know and you can help people. And I appreciate that. And now, you know, you're part of the NASCA family, you know. There's a lot of people out there that need your help.
Oh, man. Thank you, Mark, so much. I'm happy to be the NASCA, be a part of NASCA's family. And we're going to push this thing forward, and we're going to help more survivors.
Amen.
And we have, thank you, Mark. And we have Doug from Maryland. He's been listening only, so you might want to say something to Doug.
Hey there, Doug. Thank you so much for listening on today's show.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say goodnight because the show's at its end. And if you see something, say something. And there is a universal sign that children can be taught to show when they need help. And Google that. What is the universal sign that children can show you if they're in danger and need help? All right. Good night from NASCA. This is Pamela.
And this is Dr. Nancy Hamilton.
Love Talk Radio.